Enquiry Concerning Human Understanding by David Hume, first published in 1748. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. Section 10, Miracles. Dr. Tillotson has given an argument against the real presence of Christ's body and blood in the elements of the Eucharist. It is as concise, elegant, and strong as any argument can be against a doctrine that so little deserves a serious refutation. The learned prelate argues as follows.
Everyone agrees that the authority of the Scripture and of tradition rests wholly on the testimony of the apostles, who were eyewitnesses to those miracles of our Saviour by which he proved his divine mission. So our evidence for the truth of the Christian religion is less than the evidence for the truth of our senses, because even the first authors of our religion had no better evidence than that, and obviously it must lose strength in passing from them to their disciples. Nobody can rest as much confidence in someone else's testimony as in the immediate object of his own senses. But a weaker evidence can never destroy a stronger, and therefore, even if the doctrine of the real presence were ever so clearly revealed in Scripture, it would be directly contrary to the rules of sound reasoning to assent to it. It contradicts our senses, which tell us that the bread isn't flesh, and the wine isn't blood. Yet both the Scripture and the tradition on which the doctrine is supposed to be built have less evidential power than the senses have, when they are considered merely as external evidences, that is, and are not directly placed in everyone's mind by the Holy Spirit.
Nothing is so convenient as a decisive argument of this kind, which, even if it doesn't convince the opposition, must at least silence the most arrogant bigotry and superstition, and free us from being pestered by them. I flatter myself that I have discovered a similar argument, one which, if it is sound, will serve wise and learned people as a permanent barrier to all kinds of superstitious delusion, and consequently will be useful as long as the world lasts. I presume that that is how long histories, sacred and secular, will continue to give accounts of miracles and prodigies. I use prodigy to mean something amazing, extraordinary, abnormal, or the like. Though experience is our only guide in reasoning that concerns matters of fact, it must be admitted that this guide is not altogether infallible, but in some cases is apt to lead us into errors. If someone in our climate expects better weather in any week of June than in any one of December, he reasons soundly and in conformity with experience, but he certainly may find in the upshot that he was mistaken. We may observe, though, that in such a case he would have no cause to complain of experience, because it commonly informs us of such uncertainty in advance by presenting us with conflicting outcomes that we can learn about by attending carefully. Not all effects follow with the same certainty from their supposed causes. Some events are found in all countries and all ages to have been constantly conjoined together. Others are found to have been more variable, and sometimes to disappoint our expectations, so that in our reasonings about matters of fact there are all imaginable degrees of assurance, from the highest certainty to the weakest probable evidence. A wise man, therefore, proportions his belief to the evidence. In conclusions that are based on an infallible experience, he expects the outcome with the highest degree of assurance, and regards his past experience as a full proof of the future existence of that outcome. In other cases, he proceeds with more caution. He weighs the opposite experiences. He considers which side is supported by the greater number of experiences. He leans to that side with doubt and hesitation. And when at last he fixes his judgment, he doesn't accord it more than what we call probability. All probability, then, presupposes an opposition of experiences and observations, where one side is found to overbalance the other, and to produce a degree of evidence proportioned to the overbalance. We can have only a doubtful expectation of an outcome that is supported by 100 instances or experiences, and contradicted by 50, though 100 uniform experiences with only one that is contradictory reasonably generates a pretty strong degree of assurance. where there are opposing experiences, we must balance them against one another, and subtract the smaller number from the greater, in order to know the exact force of the superior evidence. Let us apply these principles to a particular instance. No kind of reasoning is more common or more useful, even necessary, to human life, than the kind derived from the testimony of men and the reports of eyewitnesses and spectators. Perhaps you will deny that this kind of reasoning is based on the relation of cause and effect. Well, I shan't argue about a phrase. All that I need for my line of thought is that our confidence in any argument of this kind is derived wholly from our observation of the truthfulness of human testimony, and of how facts usually conform to the reports witnesses give of them. It is a general maxim that no objects have any discoverable necessary connection with one another, and that all inferences we can draw from one to another are based merely on our experience of their constant and regular conjunction. So we clearly ought not to make an exception to this maxim in favour of human testimony, because there is as little necessary connection between testimony and fact as between any pair of items. If memories were not tenacious to a certain degree, if men weren't commonly drawn to truth and towards honesty, if they were not given to shame when caught in a lie, if all these were not found by experience to be qualities inherent in human nature, we would have no confidence in human testimony. The word of a man who is delirious, or is known for his falsehood and villainy, carries no weight with us. Because the evidence derived from witnesses and human testimony is based on past experience, it varies with the experience, and is regarded as a proof if the kind of report in question has been found to be constantly associated with the kind of fact it reports, and as a probability if that association is variable. There are several circumstances to be taken into account in all judgments of this kind, and the final standard by which we settle any disputes that may arise concerning them is always based on experience and observation. In cases where this experience doesn't all favour one side, there's bound to be contrariety in our judgments, with the same opposition and mutual destruction of argument as occurs with every other kind of evidence. We often hesitate to accept the reports of others. We balance the opposing circumstances that cause any doubt or uncertainty, and when we find a superiority on one side, we lean that way, though our confidence in it is less in proportion as its antagonist is strong. When human testimony is in question, the contrariety of evidence may come from several different causes: from the opposition of contrary testimony, from the character or number of the witnesses, from their manner of delivering their testimony, or from all of these together. We entertain a suspicion concerning any matter of fact when the witnesses contradict each other, when they are few or of doubtful character, when they have something to gain by their testimony, when they deliver their testimony with hesitation, or with over-violent confidence. Many other factors like these can reduce or destroy the force of an argument derived from human testimony. Consider, for instance, testimony that tries to establish the truth of something extraordinary and astonishing. The value of this testimony as evidence will be less to the extent that the fact being attested to is unusual. We believe witnesses and historians not because of any connection that we perceive a priori between testimony and reality, but because we are accustomed to find a conformity between them. But when the fact attested is of a sort that we have seldom observed, we have a contest between two opposite experiences. One of these uses up some of its force in destroying the other, and only its remaining force can then operate on the mind. In a case like this, the very same principle of experience that gives us a certain degree of assurance in the testimony of witnesses also gives us another degree of assurance against the claim the witnesses are trying to establish. And from that contradiction there necessarily arises a balanced standoff and mutual destruction of belief and authority. The Indian prince, hearing of Frost for the first time, was reasoning soundly when he refused to believe what he was told, and it naturally required very strong testimony to get him to accept facts arising from a state of nature that he had never encountered, and was so unlike anything of which he had had constant and uniform experience. though they were not contrary to his experience, these facts, involving freezing cold, didn't conform to it either. But in order to increase the probability against the testimony of witnesses, let's take a case where the fact which they affirm, instead of being only extraordinary, is really miraculous, and where the testimony, considered apart and in itself, amounts to an entire proof, because the witnesses have been found to be reliable. There is nothing suspicious about the manner of their testimony. They have nothing to gain by it, and so on. In this case, there is proof against proof, of which the stronger must prevail, but still with lessened force to the extent that the opposing side is strong. A miracle is a violation of the laws of nature, and because firm and unalterable experience has established these laws, the case against a miracle is, just because it is a miracle, as complete as any argument from experience can possibly be. Why is it more than merely probable that all men must die? That unsupported lead cannot remain suspended in the air? That fire consumes wood and is extinguished by water? Unless it is that these events are found agreeable to the laws of nature, and for things to go differently, there would have to be a violation of those laws, or in other words, a miracle? Nothing is counted as a miracle if it ever happens in the common course of nature. When a man who seems to be in good health suddenly dies, this isn't a miracle, because such a kind of death, though more unusual than any other, has yet often been observed to happen. But a dead man's coming to life would be a miracle, because that has never been observed in any age or country. So there must be a uniform experience against every miraculous event, because otherwise the event wouldn't count as a miracle. And as a uniform experience amounts to a proof, we have here a direct and full proof against the existence of any miracle, just because it's a miracle. And the miracle can't be made credible except by an even stronger proof going the other way. This clearly leads us to a general maxim that deserves of our attention. No testimony is sufficient to establish a miracle unless its falsehood would be more miraculous than the fact that it is trying to establish, and even in that case there is a mutual destruction of arguments. The assurance we get from the stronger one has to come from the force that remains to it after its loss of whatever force it needed to cancel the weaker argument. When anyone tells me that he saw a dead man restored to life, I immediately ask myself whether it is more probable that this person either deceives or has been deceived, or that what he reports really has happened. I weigh one miracle against the other, and according to the superiority which I discover, I pronounce my decision and always reject the greater miracle. If the falsehood of his testimony would be more miraculous than the event that he relates, then, but only then, he can command my belief. Part 2. In the foregoing reasoning, I have supposed that the testimony on which a miracle is founded may possibly amount to an entire proof, and that the falsehood of that testimony would be a real prodigy. But it's easy to show that this was conceding far too much, and that there never was a miraculous event established on evidence as good as that. For first, never in all of history has a miracle been attested by a sufficient number of men, of such unquestioned good sense, education, and learning, as to guarantee that they aren't deluded, of such undoubted integrity as to remove any suspicion of their wanting to deceive others, of such credit and reputation in the eyes of mankind as to have much to lose if they were caught in a falsehood, and at the same time testifying to events, the reported miracle, that occurred in such a public manner, in such a famous place, that any falsehood would be certain to be discovered. All these conditions must be satisfied if we are to be completely confident of the testimony of men. Secondly, we may observe in human nature a principle which, if strictly examined, will be found to reduce greatly the confidence that human testimony can give us in the occurrence of any kind of prodigy, leading us to reject out of hand any testimony whose truth would be unusual and incredible in an ordinary degree, but higher up the scale, the mind doesn't always stick to the same rule, for when something is affirmed that is utterly absurd and miraculous, the mind more readily accepts it on account of the incredibility that ought to destroy all its authority. The surprise and wonder that arise from miracles is an agreeable emotion, and that makes us tend to believe in events from which it is derived. And this goes so far that even those who can't enjoy this pleasure immediately, because they don't believe in those reported miraculous events, still love to partake in the satisfaction at second hand or by rebound, and take pride and delight in arousing the wonder of others. How greedily the miraculous accounts of travellers are received, their descriptions of sea and land monsters, their tales of wonderful adventures, strange men, and crude customs. But when the spirit of religion is joined to the love of wonder, there is an end of common sense, and human testimony in these circumstances loses all claims to authority. A religionist may be a wild fanatic, and imagine he sees something that isn't there. He may know his narrative to be false, and yet persevere in it with the best intentions in the world, for the sake of promoting so holy a cause. And even where this delusion about promoting a cause isn't at work, his vanity, encouraged by such a strong temptation, controls him more powerfully than others under different circumstances, and his self-interest operates with equal force. His hearers may not have, and commonly do not have, sufficient judgment to examine his evidence critically. And what judgment they do have, they automatically give up in these lofty and mysterious subjects, or if they are willing, even very willing, to employ their judgment, its workings are upset by emotions and a heated imagination. Their credulity increases the impudence of the person relating the miracle, and his impudence overpowers their credulity. Eloquence, when at its highest pitch, leaves little room for reason or reflection. It speaks only to the imagination or to feelings, captivates the willing listeners, and subdues their understanding. Fortunately, it seldom gets as far as that. But what the great orators Tully and Demosthenes could scarcely do to a Roman or Athenian audience, every itinerant or stationary teacher can do to the generality of mankind, and in a higher degree by touching such crude and common emotions. The many instances of forged miracles and prophecies and supernatural events which in all ages have either been exposed by contrary evidence or exposed themselves by their absurdity, show well enough mankind's great liking for the extraordinary and the marvellous, and ought to make us suspicious of all such tales. This is our natural way of thinking, even with regard to the most common and most credible events. For instance, there is no report that rises so easily and spreads so quickly, especially in country places and provincial towns, as one concerning marriages, to such an extent that two young persons from the same level of society have only to see each other twice for the whole neighbourhood immediately to pair them. The story spreads because people get pleasure from telling such an interesting piece of news, of propagating it, and of being the first to announce it. All this is so well known that no sensible person pays any attention to these reports until he finds them confirmed by some better evidence. Well now, don't the same passions, and others still stronger, incline most people to believe and report all religious miracles forcefully and confidently? Thirdly, reports of supernatural and miraculous events are suspect because they chiefly occur among ignorant and barbarous nations, and if they have ever been accepted by civilized people, it is because of ignorant and barbarous ancestors transmitting them with the "you had better believe this" sort of authority that always accompanies received opinions. When we read the earliest history of any nation, we are apt to imagine ourselves transported into some new world, where the whole frame of nature is disjointed, and every element works differently from how it does at present. Battles, revolutions, pestilence, famine, and death are never, in such a history, the effect of those natural causes that we experience. Prodigies, omens, oracles, and judgments push into the shadows the few natural events that are intermingled with them. But the prodigies, etc., grow thinner page by page as we advance towards the enlightened ages, and this shows us that nothing mysterious or supernatural was going on, that it all came from mankind's usual liking for the marvellous, and that although this inclination may occasionally be held back by good sense and learning, it can never be thoroughly erased from human nature. A judicious reader of these wonderful historians may think, "It is strange that such prodigious events never happen in our days." But I hope you don't find it strange that men lie in all ages. You must surely have seen enough instances of that frailty. You have yourself heard many such marvellous stories started, and then, having been treated with scorn by all the wise and judicious, finally abandoned, even by the common people. You can be sure that the famous lies that have spread and grown to such a monstrous height arose from similar beginnings, but being sown in better soil, they shot up at last into prodigies, almost equal to the ones they tell of. Here is a fourth reason that lessens the authority of reports of prodigies. There is no testimony for any prodigy, even ones that haven't been outright shown to be false, that isn't opposed by countless witnesses, so that not only does the miracle destroy the credit of testimony, but the testimony destroys itself. To understand why this is so, bear in mind that in matters of religion, whatever is different is contrary, and the religions of ancient Rome, of Turkey, of Siam, and of China can't possibly all rest on solid foundations. Every miracle that is claimed to have been performed in any of these religions, and all of them abound in miracles, is directly aimed at establishing the particular system to which it is attributed. So it has the same force, though more indirectly to overthrow every other system. In destroying a rival system, it likewise destroys the credit of those miracles on which that system was established. When we believe any miracle of Muhammad or his successors, we rely on the testimony of a few barbarous Arabs, and on the other side there is the authority of Livy, Plutarch, Tacitus, and all the authors and witnesses, Greek, Chinese, and Roman Catholic, who have told of any miracle in their particular religion. According to my line of thought, we should regard all these testimonies in the same way as if they had explicitly contradicted that Mohammedan miracle, with the same certainty as they have for the miracle they tell of. This argument may appear unduly subtle and refined, but really it's just like that of a judge who holds that the credit of two witnesses alleging a crime against someone is destroyed by the testimony of two others who affirm that the accused was many miles away when the crime was committed. One of the best attested miracles in all non-religious history is the one that Tacitus reports of the Emperor Vespasian, who cured a blind man in Alexandria with his spittle, and a lame man with a mere touch of his foot, in obedience to a vision of the god Serapis, who had told these men to go to the emperor for these miraculous cures. The story may be seen in the work of that fine historian, where every detail seems to add weight to the testimony. The story could be presented at length with all the force of argument and eloquence, if anyone now wanted to strengthen the case for that exploded and idolatrous superstition. We can hardly imagine stronger evidence for so crude and obvious a falsehood. Its strength comes from four factors. First, the gravity, solidity, age, and probity of so great an emperor, who through the whole course of his life conversed in a familiar manner with his friends and courtiers, and never put on those extraordinary airs of divinity assumed by Alexander the Great and Demetrius. Second, the historian, a contemporary writer, known for his candour and truthfulness, as well as having perhaps the greatest intellect of all antiquity, and free from any tendency to credulity, so much so that he has been charged with disbelief of atheism and irreligion. Third, the persons from whose authority Tacitus reported the miracle, who were presumably well known to have good judgment and truthfulness, they were eyewitnesses of the fact, and continued to attest to it after Vespasian's family lost the empire, and could no longer give any reward in return for a lie. Fourth, the public nature of the facts as related. Given all this, one can hardly imagine stronger evidence for so gross and memorable a falsehood. There surely never were more miracles ascribed to one person than those that were recently said to have been performed in France on the tomb of Abbé Paris, the famous Jansenist whose sanctity for so long used to delude the people. The curing of the sick, giving hearing to the deaf and sight to the blind, were talked of everywhere as the usual effects of that holy tomb. But what is more extraordinary is this. Many of the miracles were critically examined on the spot before judges of unquestioned integrity, attested by witnesses of credit and distinction, at a time when learning flourished, and on the most eminent platform in the world, the court of the Archbishop of Paris. Nor is this all. An account of them was published and circulated everywhere, and the Jesuits, though a learned body supported by the civil magistrate, and enemies of the opinions the miracles were said to have supported, were never able clearly to refute or expose them. Where shall we find such a number of circumstances converging in the corroboration of one fact? And what have we to oppose to such a cloud of witnesses but the absolute impossibility or miraculous nature of the events that they relate? And in the eyes of all reasonable people, this will surely be regarded as all by itself a sufficient refutation. Some human testimony has the utmost force and authority in some cases. For instance, when it relates the battle of Philippi or Pharsalia. But does it follow this, that all kinds of testimony must always have equal force and authority? Suppose that the Caesarian and Pompeian factions had each claimed a victory in these battles, and that the historians of each party had claimed the advantage for their own side. How could mankind, at this distance in time, have decided between them? The contrariety is equally strong between the miracles related by Herodotus or Plutarch, and those delivered by Mariana, Bede, or any monkish historian. The wise adopt a very sceptical attitude towards every report that favours the passion of the reporter, whether it glorifies his country, his family, or himself, or otherwise supports his natural inclinations and propensities. But what greater temptation is there than to appear a missionary, a prophet, an ambassador from heaven? Who would not risk many dangers and difficulties in order to achieve that? Or if through vanity and a heated imagination, a man has first made a convert of himself, and entered seriously into the delusion, will he then hesitate to use pious frauds in support of so holy and meritorious a cause? The smallest spark may here kindle into the greatest flame, because the materials are always prepared for it. The gazing populace, hungry for gossip, accept greedily and uncritically whatever supports superstition and promotes wonder. How many stories of this nature have in all ages been exposed and exploded in their infancy? How many more have been celebrated for a time, and then sunk into neglect and oblivion? So when such reports fly about, the explanation of their quick disappearance is obvious. We account for the stories by the known and natural principles of credulity and delusion, judging in conformity with regular experience and observation. Shall we, rather than availing ourselves of such a natural explanation, allow of a miraculous violation of the most established laws of nature? I needn't mention the difficulty of detecting a falsehood in any private or even public history at the place where it is said to happen, let alone at a distance, however small, from it. Even a judicial court, with all the authority, accuracy, and judgment it can employ, often finds itself at a loss to distinguish truth from falsehood concerning very recent actions. But the matter is never settled if it is left to the common method of squabbling and debate and flying rumours, especially when men's passions have taken part on either side. In the infancy of new religions, wise and learned people commonly judge the matter too inconsiderable to deserve their attention or regard. And when, later on, they would like to expose the cheat in order to undeceive the deluded multitude, it is now too late. The records and witnesses that might have cleared up the matter have perished beyond recovery. the only means of exposure that are left to us are whatever we can extract from the very testimony itself of the reporters, for example, internal inconsistencies in the reports. And these means, though always sufficient for knowledgeable people with good judgment, are usually too subtle and delicate for the common people to grasp. Upon the whole, then, it appears that no testimony for any kind of miracle has ever amounted to a probability, much less to a proof, and that even if it did amount to a proof, it would be opposed by another proof derived from the very nature of the fact it is trying to establish. It is experience that gives authority to human testimony, and it is the same experience that assures us of the laws of nature. So when these two kinds of experience are contrary, we can only subtract the lesser from the greater, and accept the greater with the level of confidence determined by what is left after the subtraction. But according to the principle I have been presenting, when popular religions are in question, this subtraction amounts to an entire annihilation. And so we may accept it as a maxim that no human testimony can have such force as to prove a miracle, and make it a legitimate foundation for any such system of religion. Please notice the restriction I put on my claim, when I say that a miracle can never be proved so as to be the foundation of a system of religion. Outside that restriction, I admit, there may possibly be miracles, violations of the usual course of nature, of such a kind that they could be proved by human testimony, though it may be impossible to find any such in all the records of history. Thus, suppose that all authors, in all languages, agree that from 1 January 1600 there was total darkness over the whole earth for 8 days. Suppose that the tradition of this extraordinary event is still strong and lively among the people, and that all travellers returning from foreign countries bring us accounts of the same tradition, without the least variation or contradiction. It is evident that our present scientists, instead of doubting the fact, ought to accept it as certain and to search for the causes for it. The decay, corruption, and dissolution of nature is an event rendered probable by so many analogies that human testimony, if it is very extensive and uniform, could suffice to convince us that something like it has happened. But suppose that all the historians who write about England were to agree that on 1 January 1600 Queen Elizabeth died, that both before and after her death she was seen by her physicians and the whole court, as is usual with persons of her rank, that her successor was acknowledged and proclaimed by the Parliament, and that after being buried for a month, she reappeared, resumed the throne, and governed England for 3 more years. I must confess that I would be surprised at the concurrence of so many odd circumstances, but I wouldn't have the least inclination to believe in so miraculous an event. I wouldn't doubt her claimed death, or those other public circumstances that followed it, but I would assert it to have been merely claimed, and that it wasn't and couldn't possibly be real. It would be no use for you to point out the difficulty and almost the impossibility of deceiving the world in such an important affair. The wisdom and solid judgment of that famous queen, the lack of any advantage that she might gain from so poor a trick. All this might astonish me, but I would still reply that the knavery and folly of men are so common that I would rather believe the most extraordinary events to arise from them than admit such a striking violation of the laws of nature. But if this supposed miracle were ascribed to a new system of religion, men have always been so much imposed on by ridiculous stories of that kind, that the mere claim of religious significance would be a full proof of deception, and would be enough to get all sensible people to reject the miracle without further examination. Though the being who is, in this supposed case, credited with performing the miracle is God, that doesn't make it a whit more probable, for it's impossible for us to know God's attributes or actions except from our experience of his productions in the usual course of nature. This still has us relying on past observation,
and obliges us to compare instances of human testimony, violating truth with miracles, violating the laws of nature, in order to judge which of the two is more probable. Now, the violations of truth are more common in the testimony about religious miracles than in testimony about any other matter of fact. So we should form a general resolution never to attend to the former kind of testimony, whatever glittering pretense it may be covered with. Lord Bacon seems to have embraced the same principles of reasoning. He says,
"We ought to have an account of everything new, rare, and extraordinary in nature, but this must be done with the most severe scrutiny, lest we depart from truth. Above all, we must consider as suspicious any report that depends in any degree on religion, as do the prodigies of Livy. And equally, everything that is to be found in the writers of natural magic or alchemy, or the like, who all seem to have an unconquerable appetite for falsehood and fable."
I especially like this line of thought, because I think it may serve to confound those dangerous friends of the Christian religion who have undertaken to defend it by the principles of human reason. Friends? Really, they are disguised enemies. Our most holy religion is founded on faith, not on reason, and a sure method of making it look bad is to subject it to a test that it cannot possibly pass. To make this more evident, let us examine the miracles reported in Scripture, and so as not to lose ourselves in too wide a field, let us confine ourselves to miracles we find in the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Old Testament. I shall examine these, not as the word or testimony of God himself, but as the work of a mere human historian. In this, I shall be following the principles of the self-proclaimed Christians, who defend Christianity, not through faith, but through reason. Here, then, we are first to consider a book that has been presented to us by a barbarous and ignorant people, written at a time when they were even more barbarous than they are now, probably written long after the events that it relates, not corroborated by any concurring testimony, and resembling those fabulous accounts that every nation gives of its origin. Upon reading this book, we find it full of prodigies and miracles. It gives an account of a state of the world and of human nature entirely different from the present, our fall from that state, the age of man extended to nearly 1,000 years, the destruction of the world by a flood, the arbitrary choice of one people as the favourites of heaven, people who are the countrymen of the author, and their deliverance from slavery by the most astonishing prodigies one could imagine. I invite you to lay your hand on your heart, and after serious thought, say whether you think that the falsehood of such a book, based on such testimony, would be more miraculous than all the miracles it tells of. That is what is necessary for those books to be accepted, according to the measures of probability I have laid down. What I have said of miracles can be applied, unchanged, to prophecies. Indeed, all prophecies are real miracles, which is the only reason for treating them as evidence for any revelation. It would be absurd to regard any prophecy as evidence of a divine mission or authority from heaven, if the foretelling of future events did not exceed the capacity of human nature. So our overall conclusion should be that the Christian religion, as well as having been at first accompanied by miracles, cannot be believed even now by any reasonable person without a miracle. Mere reason is insufficient to convince us of its truth, and anyone who is moved by faith to assent to it has a sense of his belief as a continued miracle in himself, one that subverts all the principles of his understanding and makes him believe something that is most contrary to custom and experience. End of section 10.